Wisconsin's media landscape is bracing for a pretty big shakeup. Yesterday, the Gannett Company, they own USA Today, among many other papers, announced its plans to buy the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for $280 million. That's the Journal Media Company.
Just this past June, Gannett split from the part of its company that owns broadcast media in order to focus solely on newspapers. There's some concern that the takeover could lead to consolidation and layoffs. The New York Times takes a different view, saying that Gannett is betting the local newspaper business still has a profitable future.
In a volatile media world, what does this mean for journalism in the state? How does it speak to broader trends in the industry? Katie Bartson Culver joins us now. She's assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison and associate director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Well, what was your reaction when you heard this news that the Journal Sentinel was being sold?
Well, I was surprised at how quickly it went, but not surprised that it happened. This was a long-time strategy for Gannett. They've been sort of laying in wait, I think, looking for properties that they saw as undervalued, and it's a nice testament to the Journal Sentinel's strength that they do see it as a valuable asset.
Yeah, there's been a thought over time that newspapers are dying out. Gannett is set to pay $90 million more than the Journal Media Company is valued at its current stock value. So good news maybe on one hand. On the other hand, these are bargain basement prices compared to what they might have been 10 or 20 years ago. Does this pay off in the long run for a company like Gannett?
Well, I think that's Gannett's bet that it does pay off. I think what they're trying to do here is amass an audience that they can sell to advertisers that's on par with, say, network television. They're looking at building this audience across all of these different local and regional properties and selling it as one. The question then is, what's the impact of that on the journalism for those local and regional outlets?
And let's get into that. First of all, when you hear newspaper buyout, you automatically think these days that means there are going to be job cuts. What are people expecting? I know this is still just a day into this news.
Right. I mean, anytime you hear buyout in any industry, you think lost jobs. What's interesting about Gannett's strategy is that they have tried to centralize things that don't affect the reporting operation itself. So they're centralizing design work, they're centralizing data analysis, they're centralizing the copy desk, and they've had some mixed results in that regard, but trying or saying they're going to try to keep the reporting staff at full strength. Now, Gannett itself has gone through a lot of rounds of layoffs, like any newspaper company, so you have to take all of that with a grain of salt. What's said today may not be true in 6 months, but they are trying to play this amassing of audience, and they'll only keep that audience strong if they have strong reporting.
Yeah, Gannett owns a bunch of papers around Wisconsin. Some observers have said this is close to a monopoly, except for the Wisconsin State Journal. And I've seen some people saying, hey, maybe they're going to be next. Are we going to have too few outlets competing to cover, say, the big news at the state capitol?
Well, that's been, that's been a problem forever, or at least since I wrote my dinosaur to journalism school, that we have had contractions of staff. But the reality is an entity like the Journal Sentinel isn't going to be able to keep its capital reporters, isn't going to be able to keep the beat reporters in Milwaukee working if they cannot find a way to make the business end of the operation work. So playing a bet that we're going to be able to amass this large national audience and sell it to large national advertisers, and by the way, that's not just in the print product. A very important piece is the digital product that they're trying to compete there. That may be the only way we're going to keep from contracting. But the loss in newspaper jobs over the last three decades really has posed problems for state legislature coverage, for local government coverage across the country. And it's wrong to think otherwise.
Once upon a time, the trend was synergy. You had the newspaper and maybe radio and TV all getting together. Well, the Journal Sentinel, this group they're part of, was created by stripping off broadcast from newspapers. Gannett, as we mentioned, just did that. So is this the wave of the future, newspapers only versus broadcast only, and with, of course, some new media mixed into both?
Sure. And I think the interesting part of these two spinoffs, Gannett and Journal Media Group, is how strong the digital properties were with the newspapers. The broadcast groups in these two cases are very interesting because in the Scripps Journal deal and the Gannett deal, the broadcast groups were the ones that got the debt. If you look at the Tribune Company, just to our south, Tribune Publishing was saddled with a massive amount of debt, and that's making their outlook a lot bleaker. You know, they are not poised to do what Gannett is doing. They're not attractive like Journal Media was attractive. So where we assign the debt in these spinoffs is interesting. I do think the wave now is consolidation. The trend you're going to be seeing across these print digital properties is going to be consolidation. People trying to grow bigger, people like Gannett trying to grow bigger so that they can take on other industry competitors.
We're talking to Katie Bartson-Culver. She's an assistant professor at UW-Madison. She's associate director at the Center for Journalism Ethics. Yesterday, Gannett, they own USA Today and many other papers, announced its plans to buy the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions about what this means for journalism in the state of Wisconsin? Do you read the Journal Sentinel, and what does it mean to you in the way you get your news? Overall, what role do you think local papers play today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Katie Bartson-Culver, assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. We're talking about the news announced yesterday that Gannett, the owner of USA Today, plans to buy the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions or concerns about this purchase? What do you think about the significance of local papers like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel? Do you read the local papers or do you get your news from other sources, maybe different blogs, online sources? How do papers factor into your news reading? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Katie, you mentioned the digital properties a couple times earlier. I wanted to get into that. The New York Times say they've crossed a milestone, over a million subscribers to their digital platforms, web and apps. Is that the wave of the future? Are we going to see Gannett maybe try to get that sort of subscriber base online? Is that an option for a non-New York Times outlet?
Sure. I think that's certainly going to be something that they'll be looking at. But I think in the immediate term, they won't be putting up a lot of paywalls. They'll be trying to maximize the audience across all these properties, trying to garner more revenue from advertising than from circulation.
Is that a viable option? Is advertising online paying off? Maybe not to the extent that print advertising used to, but making it worth their while?
I know it's nowhere near to the extent that it used to be, and that's really been the double whammy for newspapers. They've lost circulation, so they've lost that piece of the revenue pie, and then they've advertisers are just paying for print less than they used to, and you know, newspapers never really bounced back after the Great Recession, and they're also looking, you know, very seriously at digital metrics and trying to get the right bang for their buck out of that. So that's been, you know, really a challenging front, that revenue pie for newspapers. Gannett, I think its early strategy, I suspect, will be trying to maximize the size of that audience and work with national advertisers.
Here's a quote from Bob Dickey, the president and chief executive officer of Gannett, quoting, "Our merger will combine the best of each of our organizations to create a journalism-led, investor-focused company." Those are two different phrases, journalism-led and investor-focused. Does that pull a newspaper outlet in two different directions?
It may, and that's a real danger here, that we will be so focused on the revenue model that it'll pull away from the journalism. And one of the concerns that I have is that the Journal Sentinel, you know, we may be spoiled in Wisconsin and not recognize it, but it really is actually an international leader when it comes to investing in investigative or watchdog journalism. When a lot of papers their size and larger even were contracting in that regard and pulling away and not spending that kind of money, they actually dug in and increased their staff. It's netted them some important prizes, but it's also netted Citizen some really critical journalism. They had a fantastic series on delays in infant testing that were really costing families, you know, sometimes the lives of their children. And, you know, it resulted in change in systems. And so that investigative journalism has been very important to the state, and in that particular case, the nation. So whether Gannett will continue to support that watchdog work is a really, really key question.
I've seen in the press lately that Gannett has been, in some outlets, pushing for buyouts for longer-term employees. The older employees, they've been around longer, they cost more. There's speculation that a similar thing might happen to the Journal Sentinel. That has happened in the Journal Sentinel over the last 5-10 years under previous ownership. What does a newspaper lose when they lose those veteran reporters and that institutional memory?
They lose a lot. They lose not only the knowledge that those people bring to the table and their wisdom, of course, but also their mentoring of younger journalists. And I think this is something that people who have been working in newsrooms for 10 to 15 years will tell you hands down that it was older staff who really brought them along and showed them how to do this work. You know, as much as I'm proud of the work that I do, journalism schools do not graduate you with a degree in being an excellent reporter. You learn those skills on the job, and that mentorship and apprenticeship kind of model in the newsroom really is important, and we run risks that we're going to lose that.
And we still have TV and radio, and there's a lot of new online news outlets. How important are newspapers these days and their online incarnations in the journalism world?
They're absolutely critical, and I think we run a risk when we overstate how many new news outlets there are. You know, if you look at sort of reliable, neutral, well-reported journalism, you're not getting that from just a straight-up neighborhood blogger. Now, I think those people are very important to the information ecology, but the Journal Sentinel is doing something different than those kinds of people. I think there are promising startups like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism does tremendous work, but these newspapers, these news outlets are still incredibly important to our community.
So you mentioned that the future looks like consolidation. Do you see a paper, the other biggie, the Wisconsin State Journal, undergoing similar consolidation in the future?
You know, it could be. There are going to be acquisitions all over the place over the next 5 years. That's my guess. Actually, my guess based on some evidence. So it could be that the State Journal goes that route. You know, they certainly have had all of the revenue challenges that every other newspaper has had. The interesting thing on the local journalism level that this Gannett deal presents is that Gannett, over the last 3 to 5 years, has been using its local and regional papers in some different ways. So they, for instance, have been engaged in big national investigations using the reporting staffs of their local papers. So, for instance, the Appleton Post-Crescent contributed to a USA Today investigation on vaccination. So they did this across the country, got vaccination rates for every school in every district so that citizens could look at, you know, what percentage of students had a personal belief exemption, for instance. And so, you know, that's a pretty crafty thing to do, provide this national data resource using the staffs of all of these local papers. And it's something that the Appleton Post-Crescent could never have really done on its own. So that's an interesting trend there, and it's something that if you're working in a newsroom in one of these small, mid-sized papers, you can get pretty excited about being able to use consolidation in that way.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you so much.
That was Katie Bartson-Culver from UW-Madison looking at the new deal buying out the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Whether we notice it or not, our lives are infused with pattern. We wear striped pajamas to bed, pour honeycomb cereal into our bowls in the morning, throw on a paisley scarf maybe to keep warm. Our next guest shares the science and the stories of how these patterns, like polka dots, camouflage, and herringbone, came to be and why we like them so much.
Jude Stewart joins us now. She writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, and Fast Company. Her latest book is called Patternalia, an unconventional history of polka dot stripes, plaid, camouflage, and other graphic patterns. Jude, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jude, why do you think it pays? It's important that we pay attention to the patterns that surround us in our daily lives.
Well, I'm always interested in these things that are ubiquitous, visual signs that are ubiquitous, but, you know, just go unnoticed, because once you start noticing them, you can't unsee it. So my first book was about color, and I had that feeling about color of what are all the things that red could mean, and it's kind of amazing when you fall down that rabbit hole. And I had a similar realization with patterns. You know, at one point, it just pretty much pawing through the sock drawer, I thought, how do I know the names of all these patterns, seersucker and argyle? And, you know, you can just list name after name. But then my knowledge didn't go any further. And I thought, this is just really ripe for exploration. I mean, and when I went to look for answers, there really weren't as many as I expected. So I kind of got hooked.
Well, and there's some science behind this, too. It's not just that these things have an interesting cultural history, but it sounds like our brains actually crave patterns and want to see them.
Yes, exactly. There's a Gestalt concept called pregnance. So when we see disconnected, you know, stimuli out there in the world, you try and make a form out of it. There's some interesting kind of sideline kind of phenomena of that. There's a phenomena called pareidolia, which is the tendency to sort of see faces in random stimuli. So, when I think about an early pattern memory that I have, we had this one bathroom that was tiled up with these little hexagons, black and white hexagons, and I used to see them as little pandas. So that would be an example of pareidolia.
And there are names for things that I never knew there were names for, like when you look at an image and maybe you see a young woman with a scarf or maybe you see the old lady, and these things have words, have
exactly.
names.
Exactly, yes. The general term is apophenia, which is the tendency to sort of see a pattern where there may or may not be intended one. So when you're gambling and you're sort of feeling like you're on a hot streak, you're perceiving a pattern, but it may not actually be there statistically speaking, but that tendency is called apophenia.
And getting into the patterns themselves, you write that patterns kind of meet at the intersection of design and math. Can you explain what you mean by that and how they intersect?
Well, so I have a chapter at the end of the book that is called Off the Grid, and it was sort of the grab bag of all the interesting stories I found about pattern that didn't fit into some kind of obvious visual trope. And a lot of them I found were in math. So fractals had this really interesting story, and you're probably familiar with those posters from college dorm rooms of fractals. So it's really interesting, and the deeper that you learn about the math, the more you're kind of fascinated with the surface shape. But I really loved looking into Islamic patterning because that is sort of a perfect meld of kind of culture and math. So the goal with those patterns was to both explore mathematical concepts but to also reveal a sort of aspects of Allah. So you're trying to, in creating these patterns, you're trying to bring out certain elements of abundance or just different values of the faith, and then math is considered an equal expression of those values as a visual or, a piece of text or something else. So that was pretty cool.
Since we're on radio, can you describe what some of that Islamic patterning looks like?
Well, a lot of people are familiar with the Alhambra, which is in Spain, and that's probably the most famous example of Islamic patterning, but they have these very dense, you've probably also encountered it in the form of very ornate tile work. It informs a lot of very ornate patterning of rugs. And what's interesting a lot of times is that you can't really determine where the center of the pattern is, so that comes from the feeling that Allah is invisible and he's everywhere. The center is everywhere. So it's quite fascinating and sort of mind-bending when you look at those patterns. You can't really see where they start or stop.
And to come back to something pretty ubiquitous in America, the polka dot. Now, you would think, okay, a bunch of dots, there's not a lot of backstory there, but there is. There's a ton of backstory about polka dots. Can you tell us about their beginning origin story and a little bit about how we went from there?
Yeah. Oh, I love that story. So I looked into that, and polka dots indeed do come from polka music. There was a craze in Europe and also in America in the 1840s through the 1860s for polka music, and it was all the rage to take polka lessons and, buy lots of different sheet music and kind of always have a new polka at your party. And it was such a craze that merchandising was sort of a big part of it. So you could buy polka hats and polka pudding and polka curtains. I actually have the recipe for polka pudding, which maybe I could send to you and you can put it on your website. It sounds delicious. But then polka dot was another aspect of that merchandising craze. So we don't have the hats or the curtains anymore, but we do have this remnant in the name polka dot.
It's the dot. So what did the dot have to do with the dance? Just marketing?
That is a good question. I mean, it's one of those where to me the factual answer is not unimportant, but what's interesting is all the theories that people have. Some people say that the liveliness of the dots sort of mimics the two-step nature of the dance. There's other like kind of apocryphal stories that way, but you could probably add your own, I guess, Veronica.
Well, and then polka dots, they become this sort of Where's Waldo thing. You have the polka dot bikini. You have the supposed polka dot dress at the bystander at JFK's assassination. Polka dots just keep coming back, don't they?
They really do. And what was interesting to me was once I'd gotten to the bottom of why we called them polka dots, I really wanted to go wide angle with it. I thought, okay, well, had this kind of crazy thought experiment. What if you could go to a magical Google search type machine and you could put in not polka dots as a keyword, but just the visual, the wordless thing? What would you get back? And what would you learn about visuals that you and I would call polka dots, but other cultures would not. So that revealed this whole other side of dots. There are male initiation rituals in the Congo that are just completely covered in what we would call dots. There's Zen meditation rites involving dots. There's prison tattoos the world over that are essentially little five dots. So it revealed this whole other aspect of the dots personality.
I want to talk about just one of those before we move on, the Enso, the Zen figure. Such a fascinating history behind just this little almost circle.
Yeah, so the idea there is that you're just drawing freehand circles as a meditation device. And Zen believers would say that that's a very expressive act, that it shows all your spiritual depth is revealed in how you would make the Enso. So if you're doing this every day, and maybe for a time, you're not going to draw just one, you might draw many, many, you would end up with, you know, pages and pages full of polka dots, which is kind of fun.
We're talking with Jude Stewart right now. She's the author of the new book, Patternalia, talking about the cultural history of patterns and how they infuse our everyday life. We're getting some of the stories behind them. Now, moving on, I want to talk a little bit about camouflage. Now, this is one, again, which is pretty ubiquitous today, especially in certain fields. How did camouflage get going?
Oh, my gosh. Camouflage is so interesting. I had no idea. So camouflage, I mean, of course, starts in the natural world with animals who camouflage themselves, but really became a big thing in the human world in World War I, which is the first big war in which aerial attack was a possibility. So actually, interestingly, it wasn't initially on the uniforms that people were wearing camouflage. It was more about hiding large targets from aerial attack. So there was a little bit of dabbling in camouflage in World War I, and it was... The jury was kind of out about how successful it really was, but when World War II came around, there was just a huge doubling down on the idea of camouflage, and it spread to all the uniforms because at that point you had mass marketed uniforms. But then it became just bizarre. I mean, there was, as I say in the book, there's a story of inflatable tanks and decoy heads and entire troop movements being hidden and fake armies, and there was a magician who had a colonel's license, and he hid the entire Suez Canal for a decisive World War II victory. I mean, it just was like mind-boggling.
Right, and didn't some really famous designers not get started but end up working on some of this camouflage during World War II?
Exactly. So because they wanted to cover everything and hide all kinds of things, there were these units called camoufleurs, and the military would be recruiting people whom they might not otherwise be attracting to the military. So designers, theater set people, magicians, artists, a couple different famous people were part of the so-called Ghost Army, which was a very famous camoufleur unit. And they not only would be actually producing camouflage en masse, but they would be also teaching other people how to do it. So there was this kind of mass visual literacy campaign happening in the Army to teach yourself how to, you know, cover your face in the right way with camouflage makeup, for example.
Well, Jude, now that you've studied all of these patterns that are literally everywhere once we look and we see them, has it changed the way that you see the world?
Yeah, I would say so. It's true. When I see people, you know, wearing camouflage, I sort of immediately go to nerdily look up what the pattern is actually called. But yeah, I mean, I think it is really sort of done to me what it would, I hope, do to my readers, which is sort of awakened and informed my eye. You don't have to know this stuff, but it is so deepening of your appreciation and enriching of your sense of what's possible when you do know these things. So, so I continue to find myself sort of collecting little stories and, you know, tweeting things out. And it is a little bit like my previous book on color. It's called Roy G. Biv. It's a little endless, and I like that about it. It's very infinite.
Jude, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That was Jude Stewart. She writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, and Fast Company. Her latest book is called Patternalia, an Unconventional History of Polka Dots, Stripes, Plaid, Camouflage, and Other Graphic Patterns.